Thanks, Juan, for inviting me. And I'd like to talk a little bit about fast radio growth. So it's clearly in the radio wavelengths, but because there are lots of people working on CMBs, and CMB is also officially radio, so just specify for fast radio bursts, currently we are only seeing it in the centimeter to meter wave. So in this radio wave, we call it like centimeter to meter telescope. And just to have an overview of this field, so can you guess what is the biggest telescope in this centimeter meter wave lens at 9060s? Maybe it's not so interactive when I'm online. So it was the famous Arecibo. So it's completed in 1963 and it's a 300 meter telescope. So it's quite different from the optical telescope. The radio telescope can be super large because you don't have to build it super accurately. You just have to build it accurate to the level of centimeter. And it's almost a valley on the mountain. So now the question is, what is the largest single dish radio telescope now?
FAST.
Yeah, it is FAST. So it's completed in 2016. It's basically very similar. The design is very similar to Arecibo, and it is in China, very proud. And but it's 500 meter. So it's very sensitive, very powerful, but it takes 53 years to go from 300 to 500. So it's really difficult to get it even larger. Now it's already the size of a mountain. And it's very difficult to have an evolutionarily larger telescope. So what is the current direction is in the other end, the processing time and the price for a cheap processing per processor is dropping. So you can see from 1980 to now, it's growing exponentially. This is the y-axis is billions of computation per second. So it's really the power of computer is growing a lot. So now it's difficult to grow in terms of sensitivity, but maybe we can take advantage of this processing power. So that's generally this direction of more than radio interferometer. So for example, chime. I think Kendrick must have talked a lot about this because he is really the key people who is building up all the computing pipelines of chime, of searching. So chime, if you don't already know, is a telescope that has 1,024 receivers, and it forms 1,024 digital PE beams, and each beams are the combination of the signals from all the 1,000 receivers, and it is fixed on the ground, and it's scanning the sky 24 hours, 7 days a week. As the Earth rotates, it's surveying the sky. So the first light is in 2017. And the raw data rate is super high, but thanks for the computing power, we're only saving things when we have detections. So it's much, yeah. So just to have a view, what is the advantage of the modern interferometer is it has huge field of view. So I can see this dots are the field of view it can see on the sky. The X and Y are the RA and DEC. So for those parks, Arecibo's FAST, these are smaller than 1 square degrees, but Chime is seeing 200 square degrees something. So it's 1,000 times bigger in terms of field of view. So when it's designed, it's seeing, wow, this is such great field of view. We can survey the sky very fast. So initially it was designed for the Canadian hydrogen intensity mapping. So it's trying to survey 3/4 of the sky every day at redshift 0.8 to 2.5. But for this kind of cosmological survey, you have to calibrate your instrument very well. You have this problematic foreground, you have like a crosstalk between interferometers. So it is really a long way to calibrate the instrument before you can reach the science result. And I just see last year they started to see the cross-correlation of large-scale structural galaxies from time. However, what are the things that you can take advantage of this fast survey speed, but doesn't really need that much calibration? And that is the fast radio burst. So fast radio burst is this kind of transient. It was first discovered in 2007. It was bright millisecond duration burst in the radio frequency. So the right panel is a real image of a fast radio burst. The x-axis is time. The y-axis is frequency. So the dark lines are the fast radio burst. So it really stands out itself because of this time variation. And also you can distinguish it from this sweep that the higher frequency arrive first and the lower frequency arrive later, and the time delay follows 1/f². And this delay is caused by the individual electrons that it has encountered before reaching us. So when this signal is first discovered, no one knows where it comes from. But from this delay, you can know how much electrons it has encountered. And in this original discovery paper, they find, oh, this electron is much more than what it should encounter in the Milky Way from that line of sight. Then it must come from a cosmological distance, which is very exciting, because then it becomes a new cosmology probe, because it can tell you the total electron at different line of sight. This is not actually searching for this kind of transient signal. It's really not a new idea. Even in like 1979, there are like almost very similar searches, like done by Sterofini, which at that time was a summer student of Joe Taylor, and they've already had that attempt. But at that time, the processing time is, the bandwidth of telescope is short, is small, and the processing power is not large, so they didn't find anything. So Ster decide to become a theorist afterwards. And in 1980s, there's even a, if it's detected now, we would call it FRB. There's a radio signal detected in the nearby galaxy M87. But after the detection, like the, in the next 10 years, there are lots of follow-up to search for that signal, but didn't find anything. So it just, the interest fades away. But it is really now, it's lucky when Lorimer first find this FRB, most of the people don't believe it because it's radio. There can be lots of noises that appearing like that. But luckily in the next few years, they then continuously find similar signals. Although some of them are from microwave oven, but others are actually real astronomical signal. So this field was getting heated because it's a parameter that's previously much less explored, but now we have this computing power to explore it. But it is really after the chime is online, this field is really greatly moving forward. So this is the number of FRB detected against years. And you can see after chime is online, other bars are almost invisible. It is really producing the largest number of detections. So what do we know about FRBs? So first of all, it's very energetic. So the look at the right panel, the x-axis is duration, the y-axis is spectral luminosity. So FRBs are really like this orange blobs are normal pulsars, and these black across are the giant radio pulses from the crab pulsar, and the green, the blue ones are the fast radio burst. So it is like seven orders of magnitude higher than normal pulsar. They're really energetic, so that we can see it outside of our galaxy. And like for the spectral luminosity, it's almost similar to the AGN. So it's impressive. Because this is energy per unit time per unit frequency, because this is very short, the total energy is not that large, but per unit time per unit frequency, the energy is really high. So, and the second is the sky rate. We roughly know that it's 1,000, almost around 1,000 per sky per day, about 1 J/ms at L band, which means that if you only have less than a square degree field of view, it takes hundreds of days for you to see one burst if you're staring at it all time. So you really need a large field of view to be able to detect a reasonable number for studies. And after that, like there are lots of observations, but I would think most of the important leap forward are among few very small, very few observations. One of them is the discovery of the first repeaters. So in 2016, Laura Spittler using Arecibo find that one of the FRB, previously you just see a burst and you stare at it and you never see it come back. But that was the first time you actually staring at the burst and you see it comes back, which means that at least part of the FRBs, if not all, are non-catastrophic events. And now we sort of, from the time example, we're seeing like probably 4% of the FRBs repeat, contributing to 10 to 20% of the total bursts. But this number could change as time evolves. It depends on what's the actual fraction of FRB that repeats. The second thing is, this is significant because that means it's not not emitted during a merging thing, because it has to come back, and it has to come back for the first repeater, it has to come back steadily for more than 10 years. 10 years so far, but it's still going. So it has to be something that lasts more than 10 years. And also the second very milestone detection is made together with CHIME and STAIR 2, which is small telescope and built by Greg Sweden at Caltech. So it was a detection of FRB-like burst from a galactic magnetar. So if you look at this figure again, so the magnetar burst is the black a star. So it's not at the level of most of the FRBs, but it's very definitely closer to the FRBs than the normal pulsars. We're showing that magnetar actually, this is the first time showing that magnetar actually are able to generate those kind of very energetic bursts. It's just so rare that previously not caught, but it was caught in the CHIME side lobe. So CHIME has this 2000 square degree field of view, but actually it can actually but the side lobe can actually see the see any kind of object as long as it's above the horizon. It's just the sensitivity is 1,000 times lower than the normal one. But for this galactic events that is super bright and super close, it can see it as long as it's above the horizon.
How
does this identify as a magnetar? So what follow-up? How is it
done? Identify. Sorry, I can't hear it quite well. So how does this identify as a magnetar? What other instruments
So this one is actually known to be a magnetar. It has the normal magnetar behavior, X-ray flares. It's known before this radio observation. So it's known to be a magnetar for a long time, but it's just recently we see that there's a radio burst happening from that object.
Hi, thank you.
So magnetar, just in case it's, so magnetars are neutron stars with extremely high magnetic field of like 10 to the 14 to 16 Gauss, and the neutron stars are the core of massive giant stars, just in case it's not obvious. And so, yeah, so that one is actually, although there are still debate of how magnetar generate this radio burst, like how it escaped from the magnetosphere, or it's some shock wing, but I think it's generally now settled that magnetar can produce FRBs, but we don't know yet whether all FRBs are produced by magnetar and what's the fraction of FRBs. It could be other one, but really, what is the fraction? So moving forward, there are like more than 600 published FRBs, and we have lots of improved understanding of progenitors. But really, there are things we still don't quite understand, and those things that potentially can be crucial. One of the things is, of course, the long-term periodicity that I found in 2020. So before then, like the burst, some of the FRB we see it repeats, but we don't know when it repeats. It seems pretty sporadic. And there are lots of attempts to search for period, but none of that was very convincing. But after CHIME has launched, there are more repeaters, and also CHIME, because it's fixed on the ground, so it can has regular daily exposure. So I think, well, at that time, maybe most of the search are towards short periodicity, but because we have this regular daily exposure, I think maybe I can expand the parameter space to search for longer term periodicity. And also that was also, if you have a gravitational length FRB, that was the by a galaxy will be order of 10 days. So I think, well, maybe I should give it a shot, not that I'm very confident, but could try. And then we find this source. That was the most active repeaters in the CHIME samples. So the x-axis is time. The bars are the sensitivity of CHIME. So CHIME is sort of have a stable sensitivity across days, and it has almost daily exposure. But really, this source only burst in the narrow windows, which indicated in these gray shadows, and it appears fairly regularly. So last time I saw this regularity is when I searched, like when the US people searched Turkey on the Google Trend, and this is what I see. So it appears really regularly during the Thanksgiving. Some of this FRB seems to have some pattern. It's not, and if I follow this pattern in terms of this 16-day period, you can see that it only appears, the bursts are appearing in this plus minus three, in this like 3-day window, but it's only active in 1/3 of the phase space. It's not a trivial to justify the significance because of the burst is non-Poisson, so the statistics are less well-defined. And there's some beef because this sidereal day observation, there could be hours of period, but it looks like 16-day period. But really, with lots of other telescope and also this period just stays stable even to now. I can't even find the P dot. It's just stable 16-day.334 period that's still currently very stable after 3 years. I really find this sun effect not super. I have
difficulty. You can move on. Sorry about that.
Sorry, but I really want to understand it, but I can't hear it clearly. And so at that time, because this one, you know when it's happening, so it's very efficient to follow up, because you just need to spend this one third of this total time to stare at it, and you know that your chances are much higher. So it triggers very high efficiency of follow-ups. There are lots of multi-wavelength follow-ups. And also it pushes the detection of FRB down to the frequency low 0.1 gigahertz from low far, which haven't observed like any sources at that low frequency before, showing that it's not absorbed at that low frequency. And also the rate is actually even higher. And also the surprising thing is this source is active at 600 megahertz, which is the time band at one phase window. But at different frequency, the active phase seems to be different. So in a follow-up paper, they follow up with low far and aperitif. Low far is at 0.1 gigahertz, aperitif at 1.4 gigahertz, while time is at 0.6 gigahertz. So you can see that the aperitif, the green window, appears first, and then the time appears second, and then the low far appear last. So they're actually not simultaneous at different frequency. And we still don't quite understand that. So there are lots of theory, even till now, like there are still attempts to explain that. Like, for example, Juan also has this very nice theory about, maybe I spent that. companion-induced precession. So it's generally three direction, because it has to be related to some circular motion for it to come back with a period. So it's generally three direction, binary, precession, or spin. I kind of like Juan's idea. Not that I find it super convincing, but I like the fact that maybe it can connect to this potential LISA source. So his idea is you have a companion very close to the neutron star, and then it introduces some force precession. And also you can have a neutron star precess itself, so that it comes to your line of sight at a specific time. Or like if the magnetar has a super slow spin, but or it has a companion. So all of them can be very important. First of all, like we've never seen magnetar that can spin that low at 16 days. And more significantly, if it spins at 16 day period, but it's still able to be so active and generating burst all the time. That's non-trivial. If that's true, that's something related to the neutron star itself that we don't understand, and can potentially be something related to the crust quick or something, we don't know. And the precession is also for the free precession, it's difficult to preserve it in the young magnetar. It will diffuse out pretty fast. However, so far we still haven't seen any period derivative of this 16-day period. So it's non-trivial to preserve, to have it, and non-trivial to have it like still so stable. And for the binary, it's also not obvious why, if it's something emitted by the magnetar, like why it has to preferentially has a companion. It has to be something, the companion has to trigger it or something. Otherwise, there's no reason that this most active one, it just happened to be the one with a companion. So it's still, so far we don't know what is the answer. And one of the things that we can test is, I wrote this with the former CETA postdoc, that because the different models are basically all explaining this periodicity with a geometric effect. If the emission is magnetospheric, then that means that there has to be a fixed emission region for the geometric effect to work. And for different models, the geometry is different. And one of the things that to test the geometry is through the polarization measure. So the position angle. So for each burst you detect, you can measure the position angle between the two linear polarization. And that is telling you the geometry where the emission was emitted. So for the slow magnetar at different phase, it should have a fixed polarization angle. While for precession, it's more of a blob because it also have a spin motion in addition to the precession motion. And for the free precession and the forced precession actually has an additional symmetry between phases. So I have a student at Max Planck trying to measure the polarization angles of different at different frequency at different phase, but it's sort of a difficult measurement. But I'm just saying that there are different models, but there are ways to test them, and this can be one way. And also we are also trying to find more. Hopefully find more potential periodic sources, but it's because of this non-Poisson statistic. And also this one is really so active, others might not be so active. So we're still on our effort. There are some candidate, but we're not so convinced yet. This is one thing, this mysterious but stable 16th period of FRBs. And the second mystery is the location of the fast radio burst. So all magnetars currently we observe in our galaxy are found very close to the galactic plane, consistent with their very young age of 10 to the 5 years. So you move like a parsec away from your plane. However, a population of FRBs are localized to massive red low star forming host galaxies, which you don't expect magnetar to appear in those galaxies. And also even for those FRBs localized to star forming galaxies, they are often seen to be offset from the peak of the star forming region. And if you interpolate the age of this source from like the offset divided by the characteristic velocity of neutron star low few hundred kilometer per second, you get an age of greater than 100 mega year, which is 10 to the 8 years, while the characteristic magnetar is less than 10 to the 5 years. And really one very strong observation is like in the 2021, there's the most nearby FRB was localized to a globular cluster 3.6 megaparsec away. So the right panel shows this observation. So this is the M81, which is the normal galaxy, just like our Milky Way. But where is the FRB here? It's at like this arrow, and there's a globular cluster there. So it's really far from the star forming region of this galaxy. So globular cluster hosts old population. It has no star forming going there. And what is even more surprising is like, even if there's some procedure that doesn't take star formation, reason star formation, the total stellar mass in the globular cluster compared to the galaxy is like 0.001%. So really it's just like but this one is really the most nearby FRBs. And for further away, we were not able to localize it to a globular cluster. We're not able to see the globular cluster. But this the most nearby one is in the globular cluster. If you naively interpolate from the stellar mass fraction, you expect to see hundreds of FRBs already in the galaxy when you see one in the globular cluster. But we don't. This is the most nearby one. It's just like you go to China and the first one you met is a Caucasian. It's just so strange. But it's global cluster. It's dynamically active. So maybe it's probing some dynamic channels. For example, with one of the postdocs at the Caltech, we had this calculation of different for dynamic channels. And one of the most promising one is the Superchandrasekhar white dwarf merger. So if you assume all the Superchandrasekhar white dwarf merger will form magnetar, and the magnetar can stay active for 10 to the 5 years, which is already in the very kind of old magnetar age, you expect to see one at the distance of M81. But still, that sort of can explain the rate, although it's not currently known whether this channel exists, because there are also stories about white dwarf merger and throw away all the materials. But even if you assume 100% succeed rate, you can roughly make one at that distance. But still, it's sort of difficult to explain why you don't see more in the normal galaxies. So it's an interesting source, and definitely it is not an FRB from a normal magnetar. Maybe it's dynamically formed magnetar, but definitely not a normal magnetar. It has to be some other population that's away from the normal magnetar. And what is the fraction of this in the whole population? We don't know. But based on this one sample, it could be a reasonable fraction that that needs consideration. So how can we find more examples of this? One thing is you can keep localizing it, but as the distance goes further away, it's just difficult to see the globular cluster. Maybe we're able to localize it to the global cluster. We just can't find it in the optical or something. It's just tiny. Another way to do is like you can find staring at nearby galaxy with tons of globular cluster. So in naively interpolate this result, like we in total have only 1,000 globular cluster up to the distance of M81. But there are galaxies like Virgo A, which is M87, which has 15,000 globular clusters. So if you naively interpolate, you should see like 10 sources. So starting 2021, I've been observing this M87 galaxies. So with the FAST, which is currently the most sensitive telescope, and naively, I would expect like 5 per hour, but so far I've carefully spaced the observation to be like 2 hours every few months, but so far I haven't found anything. But I think it's still worth looking just to find this special population, and I'll mention later why I'm specifically interested in this population. This is the second thing, the localization of FRBs. Some of them doesn't seem to be consistent with this magnetar picture. The third confusing thing about FRB is the magneto environment. So just a short introductory look, our measurement of magnetic field. So we use Stokes parameter, I is the total intensity, QU is components of linear polarization, V is circular polarization, and the total linear fraction is Q squared plus U squared, take a square root of that. And in the normal ISM or IGM, the the magnetic field is low, the electron density is low. So what we see is Faraday rotation, which is a QU rotation with wavelength square dependence. We can distinguish that very well. But in some of the case, if you have relativistic electron pair plasma or extremely large magnetic field, or if your magnetic field is not only large, but it's having a reversal, you can sometimes mix the linear and circular polarization. The cases are really rare, unlike the Faraday rotation, which is integrated along line of sight. For this Faraday conversion, it's usually happening in some special area in the line of sight, which is rare, but it's important because once we see it, we distinguish some special area and we can give tight constraints of this area. So now talking about the polarization effect of fast radio bursts. So some of the fast radio bursts are among those with the largest rotation measure we see. So rotation measure is the amount of Faraday rotation it has encountered, which is the integral of electron density times parallel magnetic field. You can see, so those are the x-axis is time, the y-axis is RM. So the blue one is one fast radio burst. This is even greater than the RM of the galactic magnetar. So this previously, most of the pulsar are having RM of 100 something. Only this galactic magnetar, because it's near a supermassive black hole and it's probing the magnetic field near the black hole and it's having super high RM, but some of the FRBs are even greater than this. And none of the FRBs are localized to the center of the galaxy that's supposedly having a massive black hole. They just, some of them seems to even offset from the star forming region, but somewhat they have very active magnetic environment around it. And also you can see this yellow line, which is the galactic magnetar. It's changing, but it's not changing that dramatically. While most of the FRBs with large magnetic field, it seems to change in the time scale of a few months and it's changing really fast. If you think about this, generally map this time to a spatial scale by the velocity of motion, assuming normal neutron star of 100 kilometer per second, it's mapping to a few AU. It's very small scale fluctuation. So what is that? And not only this, some of them even have this oscillation in circular polarization, which, as I said, it only happens if you have encountered some special region where you can convert this linear to circular. So for one of the FRB, it seems to even go through like three layers, like a cold plasma magnetoactive layer, and then some relativistic layer, and then another layer of cold plasma. And what is that? Is that like a supernova remnant or a companion? We don't know, but it's certain something that's not happening normally. So one of the inspiration can come from the pulsar with companions. So recently, we have this paper, which is currently accepted by Nature, that we looked at a pulsar binary. So it's a pulsar in a globular cluster, which has a low mass binary, extremely low mass binary, only solar radius away. So this is the circular polarization of the pulsar. The x-axis is the spin phase. The y-axis is the orbital phase. So for this one, it's very good. We know what's the location of the relative position of the companion and the pulsar. You can see that in the normal phase, at orbital phase 0.75, when the companion is behind the pulsar, means it's not disturbing it. This is the polarization. And when at phase 0.25, when the companion is in front of the pulsar, you can see this, so this red and blue are the positive and negative circular polarization. You can see when the companion moves in front of the pulsar, the circular polarization flips signs. So the red becomes blue, the blue becomes red. So this one is, this is, I really like pulsar binary in terms of study correlation set, because for this phase, it tells you what is the intrinsic polarization after it's emitted by the pulsar. And this one is additional propagation after it comes through the plasma of the companion. And we can model it, because for the simplest assumption, we assume that all the spin phase are experiencing the same propagation effect. And then with that, we can model, well, different propagation effect will change the profile in different ways, and also change the profile in different frequencies. So in this way, we can model it very nicely. So the left panel is the intrinsic phase. The right panel is the dots are the data, and the curves are my fitting. So it really fits very well for all spin phase and against different frequencies. So just to zoom in, it has all these kind of wiggles, and I have no parameters against spin phase, but I can reproduce all the wiggles pretty well. And with that, it tells me what is the eclipsing. So what is the absorption phenomenon? What is the absorption effect? And what is this conversion effect? And for that, the most plausible explanation is it has go through this colloidal magnetic field of the companion. And because along this colloidal magnetic field, the magnetic field component parallel to the line of sight flips signs. And when the magnetic field is large enough, the circular polarization will follow it and flip signs. So this is some simulation. So this requires the companion to have magnetic field greater than 10 Gauss. And not only like this, this system also see this rotation measure changes, which I said previously, which is the parallel magnetic field integrated with electron density. And it is when the magnetic field is weak. So when the companion is right next to the line of sight, it changes the circular. But when the companion is almost like behind the lens, sideways to the line of sight, it changes the rotation measure. And it changes rotation measure. This red dots are the rotation measure. It can go both negative and positive, and it can change really fast for 100 unit. However, this one, we cannot observe single pulse. We have to integrate for 20 seconds. So you can see actually when there are lots of electrons and the line of sight approaches the companion, I can no longer measure the linear polarization. But which means that there can potentially, if I took this 20 Gauss from the previous constraint, I can have RM of a 10 to the 6. However, I'm not able to measure that because it's depolarized, because it's changing too fast. But when the magnetic field is still weak, when the companion is slightly far away, I see this RM changes 100 Gauss. So you can compare this system with the things we observe with fast radio burst. It can have large irregular RM variation, can have depolarization, it can have polarized absorption and sporadic conversion and propagation induced V, and it can really explain lots of phenomena we observe with fast radio bursts. So maybe this weird polarization behavior of fast radio bursts can be produced by a companion, or even if it's not, like our study, the pulsar binary and the propagation effect can help us understand what's happening there in fast radio bursts. In addition to this polarization, there's also this 16 period and the globular cluster localization. All of them is like weakly for all this case, all those weirdness I mentioned before, like the companion is one of the model that has been proposed. None of them are super convincing, but they all seems to slightly suggesting companion. So it just means that it's something we can seriously consider. It's not settled that it's an interesting direction.
So and don't look at the question.
Yeah. It's almost yeah.
So yeah. So you have this model which can have this model which can help you to compute the propagation effect. So you assume you know the magnetic field and plasma density of the companion, and then you just rotate your companion along the orbit and then do some ray tracing. Is that how you compute the propagation effect?
Not really. I'm actually doing something much simpler than this. So I fit for it to see what propagation effect happens. And I know the electron density from the dispersion measure, which is the electron column density. And then I can interpolate the magnetic field.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's also some potential things to look for, because there's actually started to have some polarization study, but there could be more in the future. So that's the current status. So in the next few years, so this is time, this there will be more instrument starting to commission. So this is the x-axis is the sensitivity, the y-axis is field of view. So going to the left side is more detection, but going to the right side is more nearby sources. Going to the left side is more cosmological FRBs. Going to this direction is more detection. So this is time, this is fast, but in the next few years, there will be DSA, which 2000, if it happens, it will detect more cosmological FRBs with higher rate. There's also Weili trying to build in Taiwan the BURST, which try to detect more nearby FRBs to study the progenitor models. And also in the next few years, CHIME is going to have out-triggers, which I started to see like the nearby Allen by cylinder has been working, and the green bank is the hardware is built. So in the next few years, CHIME is going to have a localized few thousand FRBs. Next few years, CHIME is going to localize greater than 1,000 FRBs to less than 50 milliarc second in 2 years, and DSA 2000 is going to localize 10 to the 4 FRBs to 3 arc second. And just to have a view, this is the CHIME baseband localization, which is only bound to few burst, not yet. The catalog is mostly about it's even more like 10, 20 arc minute, and the baseband is going to do 1 arc minute, and the DSA is going to do like a arc second, and the timeout trigger is going to do milliarc seconds. So the previously you can only localize it to a galaxy, but in the next few years, you're really going to see what's the nearby environment. And also there will be opportunities when you have more nearby sources, opportunities for multi-wavelength follow-ups in both X-rays, opticals, and other things. I'm probably going off time. And really with more FRBs, there will be more like cosmological applications. Like now there are already attempts to measure the total baryon content based on the redshift distribution and the dispersion measure, which is electron column densities of FRBs. And also FRBs, because it can probe electron column density of different line of sight, they actually are sensitive to all spatial scales. Unlike CMB at large scales, because the primary CMB is very noisy, for FRB, it's almost similar to all scales. So it can probe lots of the chances of probing lots of other things, cross-correlate with KSC. And there are already attempts to cross-correlate FRB location with nearby galaxy to see whether FRBs passing nearby galaxy has additional dispersion measure. This is to probe the circumgalactic medium, and it seems to have few hundred contributions, and in the next few years, it will be more. And there's also cross-correlation of FRBs with galaxy position, which Kendrick and I are both involved in, seems to see that FRB at redshift point four are correlated with FRBs of BM of 800, which is a surprising result. So it really have lots of chances to probe like matter distribution at lots of different scales. But really there's also concerns. For example, previously when measuring the total baryon contribution, those are the FRB used. But later on studying the repeaters, some of them really have really high excess DMs, and those can contaminate the sample a lot, and how to distinguish them and how to get a clean sample is are some tasks to do. For example, those are also the sources with active RM. Should we exclude sources with active RMs? And also, the part of the reason I'm very interested in this globular cluster FRB is like for whatever dynamics scenario in the global cluster, first of all, it doesn't have much host contribution. The dispersion measure in the global cluster is like 0.1 parsec per centimeter cube. And also whatever dynamic procedure it generates this FRB, it's not going to have some much circumburst contribution. So if we want to have some cosmological samples, those FRBs can be a clean samples. So they can have much less contribution from the host, and those can be golden samples. And especially they seem, some of them seems to have characteristic behavior, like it has very narrow time structure that haven't been seen in other FRBs. So maybe if we have a large enough samples, we can find some property that we can distinguish this sample from other sample, even if we can localize it directly. So yeah. So just trying to look for more. Well, I think I'll end here. I think I'm using too much time. So in general, like currently FRB has been really heated, and this field is moving forward a lot. It's a new parameter space open, and there are still lots of puzzles that keep this field interesting, and there can be interesting populations that allow us to probe things that we're previously not aware of. And in the next few years, with the number of FRB increases, there can be more studies of the cosmological application of probing matter distribution at different scales. So I'm pretty optimistic that there will be significant progress in the next 10 years. And there's greater opportunity for a greater community, like considering the dynamic formation channel and the cosmological application and the statistic tool of how to do it less biasly. And thank you very much.
Questions? Hey, Zhongzi, very nice talk. So you mentioned that there is some mild evidence for the existence of FRB companions. Do you know what kind of companion it is? Is it normal stars or black holes, neutron stars?
We don't know. I think that one is much less developed. I'm not even sure if there are companions, but there are models like a massive. So for a massive stars or a black hole, that is something that's more natural to introduce the active RM variation. So a B stars or something, that is something can provide at a few AU orbital separation can naturally explain those RM variations. So AIC, so there's also this perception of like having a companion very close to it. This just like this AIC, like a model, like but I think it's generally much less developed. It's still pretty hand waving at this point.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, thanks for the nice talk. So I was wondering if you could elaborate just a little more on that bullet point you had on your last slide where you're making a connection to like Lisa sources. So is the idea there that you would see like a binary white dwarf merger with Lisa or something and then follow it up and look for a mass radio first, and that might be connected to the kind of mass radio that you saw in the popular cluster?
Google Plus. Yeah, I was hoping to detect more. Well, sorry, I somewhat this sound effect. So are you asking, am I expect to see more FRBs from the galaxy with lots of Google cluster or something? Or
I'm just on your last slide, you had this connection to Lisa sources. So I just wonder if you could elaborate on that. The idea you'd see like gravitational waves with Lisa from binary white dwarfs and like potentially see a merger and then a fast radio burst afterwards, or I just wanted to understand what you had in mind there.
Oh, I see. So for the merger model, there are lots of merger models. So there are the pre-merger model, like which is like when it's getting really close for 100 years before merger, it can emit fast radio bursts. And for the one that after you form magnetar and then magnetar emit burst, that's a very different time scale because the magnetar can stay active for 10 to the 5 years. So it's after the merger, it's 10 to the 5 years. It's not going to find a coincidence. Let me think what are the, yeah, I think only the pre-merger model will be interesting for the gravitational wave. The post-merger one, I think the time scale will be too different. And also the rate will be, just doesn't work very well because, then you just have much more FRV sources than like the merger cases because it can stay active for 10 to 5 years. But the pre-merger one, it is also the phase that you should see the gravitational waves like Fender Lisa.
Yeah, thanks.
Any other questions? Okay, maybe I can come back to the 16 days period. So let's say if we don't see any change in the period for the next 10 years, I mean, given the accuracy of your period measurement, I guess then this P dot must be extremely small, much smaller, orders of magnitude smaller than those predictions from this newborn magnetars, right? Like so for those models, the spin down rate should be pretty fast.
Yeah.
And, then what are the viable expectations then? So.
First of all, I just in general wasn't super prefer precession model, partly because, well, it can have a shock, of course, but if it's magnetospheric, then it shouldn't have a very flat polarization angle as we observe right now. But in terms of the P dot constraint, it's actually pretty poor. So it's just telling you that it's the age is more than 100 years. If I'm doing it for 5 years or doing it for 10 years, it's actually not that much different. It is like 100 years or like 200 years or 400 years. And I think they probably can find a way to get around. I think the, yeah, for the magnetospheric model, the PA constraint is stronger. And for the shock model, I think the PA change against frequency will be stronger constraint than the P dot.
So the accuracy is, you're saying it linearly scales with your observation time, not quadratic?
Hmm?
So you're saying the accuracy just linearly scales with your observation time, not quadratically scales?
Let me think. I think so. One second. Maybe I'm wrong. Yeah, no. I think probably quadratic. But yeah, it's sorry. I've doing that for a while ago. But now that you're talking about that, yes, it's a quadratic curve to find the P dot. It should be quadratically related to the time observing it or square root. Yeah, maybe quadratic. Yeah, but I still find it like, well, then like observing for 10 years is like four times more accurate. It's still, you probably need an order of magnitude to be interesting. Or even if it's interesting, it's like those models are slightly hand wavy. It's maybe they try really hard, can squeeze in another order of magnitude.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, any question from online audience?
So I had a question. Yeah, like you might have mentioned this already. Sorry. But you showed how, you know, the RM can change significantly on timescales of months. Does the DM also change on similar timescales or no?
No, DM changes are much less obvious if there's any change. So it's sort of marginal to the resolution. So it's, and also DM has this structure confusion, but anyway, DM doesn't have significant changes.
Okay, if you agree, then.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. If no more questions, let's thank Deng Zhu again for the nice talk.